A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel just got back from 3 weeks in Connecticut with his in-laws, and the thing that's been rattling around his head isn't a fight or a cold shoulder or anything like that. It's tuna. Standing in the grocery aisle, holding a can of tuna, trying to remember if they already have this brand, feeling the weight of a judgment he's not even sure exists. Or sitting at a restaurant, full, looking at half a plate of food and feeling like leaving. It's a statement about the meal. The in-laws are good people. He likes them. He says that up front, and I believe him. The tension isn't between him and them. It's between him and the version of himself he imagines they see. A phantom audience that's keeping score on leftovers and grocery choices. And the irony, as Daniel points out, is that he keeps leftovers at home. He thinks restaurant portions are too big. He has medical reasons for eating smaller meals, so he's not fighting their values. He's fighting a projection of their values that he's built in his own head, and he's losing. His question is, what mental work can he do between now and the next visit so he can just be comfortable being himself under their roof?
So what's actually happening in our heads when we spend 3 weeks under someone else's roof, even when we like them?
That's the thing. This isn't a bad relationship problem. The usual advice, just talk to them, set boundaries, communicate, doesn't quite land here because there's no conflict to resolve. The machinery is internal.
Right. And I think the term for what Daniel is describing, this state where you're trying so hard to be a good guest that you lose track of what you actually need, I'd call it hypervigilant prosociality. You're monitoring yourself so intensely for potential social infractions that your own hunger cues, your own preferences, your own comfort get drowned out. You're not eating because you're hungry. You're eating to manage someone else's hypothetical impression of you.
Hypervigilant prosociality. That's a mouthful.
It's a thing. And it's distinct from social anxiety in general because it's context-specific and it's prosocial in intent. You're not avoiding people. You're trying to be excellent for them. The problem is, the trying becomes so effortful, it backfires.
So the episode is about the gap between objective social reality and our internal model of it. Specifically in high proximity, low escape family contexts, where the guest role strips away normal environmental control. And we're going to focus on the internal dynamics, not relationship advice, because the relationship here's fine. The question is, what's happening inside Daniel's head, and what skills actually address that?
Let's start with the mechanism, the specific psychological machinery that makes this situation challenging.
The spotlight effect. This is the baseline. People consistently overestimate how much others notice and remember about their behavior. You think everyone's watching you. They're not. They're watching themselves.
And the classic demonstrations of this are almost comical. Researchers had students wear embarrassing t-shirts, Barry Manilow, something uncool, and then walk into a room. The students estimated that about half the people in the room would notice the shirt. The actual number was closer to 20%. People are simply not cataloging your behavior the way you think they are.
The tuna aisle. Daniel's standing there, running an internal simulation of what his mother-in-law would think if he buys the wrong brand. Meanwhile, she's 3 aisles over deciding between 2 kinds of bread and hasn't thought about the tuna once.
Probably not even that. She's probably thinking about what to make for dinner tomorrow, or whether Ezra is napping well, or any of 100 things that have nothing to do with Daniel's grocery choices. But here's where it gets interesting. The spotlight effect is the baseline for everyone, everywhere. Family settings amplify it.
Why?
2 reasons. First, the stakes of social rejection are higher with family. A stranger thinking you're wasteful, that's a blip. Your in-laws thinking you're wasteful. That's a relationship you have to maintain for decades, across visits, across oceans. Every interaction carries more weight because the history is longer and the future is longer. Second, there's norm ambiguity. When you're in someone else's home, you don't know the exact rules about food, space, timing, hospitality. Your brain fills in the gaps, and it tends to fill them in with stricter versions than probably exist.
The uncertainty creates a vacuum. and the vacuum gets filled with worst-case assumptions.
No, that's right. The brain defaults to the most socially costly possibility. If you're not sure how much leftover is acceptable to leave, the safe assumption is none. If you're not sure whether buying tuna they already have is a faux pas, the safe assumption is yes, it is. The brain isn't trying to be accurate. It's trying to avoid the worst outcome, and it calibrates accordingly.
So Daniel's standing there with the tuna, and his brain is running a cost-benefit analysis where the cost of being judged as wasteful is high, and the cost of just not buying the tuna is low. So he puts the tuna back. Problem solved. Except it's not solved, because he didn't want the tuna in the first place. He wanted to contribute to the household, or he wanted a specific kind of tuna he likes, and now he's denied himself that for a judgment that probably wasn't coming.
And this connects to something Daniel mentioned that I think is really important. He already keeps leftovers at home. He already believes in the practice. So in theory, he should be more relaxed in this environment, not less. He's aligned with their values. But what happens instead is that knowing the standard makes him more anxious about failing to meet it consistently in a context where he can't control the variables.
The irony of self-awareness. He knows what good looks like, so he knows exactly how he might fall short.
At home, he controls the grocery list, the meal timing, the portion sizes, the container system. In Connecticut, he controls none of that. He's operating in someone else's system, and the system's rules are partly invisible to him. So he's trying to be a good guest according to standards he can only guess at, while also managing his own medical needs around portion sizes, while also wanting to participate in shared meals without feeling uptight. That's a lot of cognitive load.
And 3 weeks is a long time to carry that load.
This is the part most people miss. Short visits, 2-3 days, you can perform. You can be the best version of yourself, the gracious guest, the easygoing son-in-law. But the guest performance has a shelf life. Around day 5 to 7, the cognitive load of maintaining that persona becomes exhausting. You can't keep it up, and the exhaustion creates irritability that gets misattributed.
You think you're annoyed at your in-laws, but you're actually annoyed at the effort of constant self-monitoring.
Right. And that misattribution is dangerous because it can create real relational friction where none existed before. You're short with someone, or you withdraw from a shared meal, and they interpret that as you being distant or ungrateful. But what's actually happening is you're depleted. Your executive function is tired. The part of your brain that manages impressions and suppresses impulses is running on empty.
So the mechanism is, spotlight effect makes you overestimate how much they're watching. Norm ambiguity makes you fill in the blanks with worst cases. The guest performance is unsustainable past about a week. And the resulting exhaustion gets mislabeled as relational tension. That's the machinery.
And Daniel's situation adds one more layer, the compression of time. His in-laws live across the world. These visits are precious and infrequent. There's no next weekend to smooth things over. Every interaction feels higher stakes because the opportunity is scarce. The research on high-stakes social interactions confirms this. Perceived scarcity of opportunity increases anxiety. When you know you won't see someone for another year, you feel pressure to get it right.
That resonates. If you have dinner with your in-laws every Sunday, one awkward meal is nothing. If you have 3 weeks with them and then you're gone for a year, every meal carries the weight of the whole relationship.
So we know why it happens. The harder question, the one Daniel is really asking, is what you can actually do about it.
And his framing is interesting. He didn't ask for conversation scripts or boundary-setting techniques. He asked about the skill of being comfortable being yourself, which is a real thing, not a platitude. What does that actually consist of, as a practiced ability?
I think the foundation is something psychologists call self-concept clarity in social contexts. It's the ability to maintain a stable sense of who you are and what you need, regardless of the social environment. People who have it can walk into a new situation and not lose track of their own preferences. People who don't have it, and I think this is most of us to varying degrees, get pulled around by the perceived expectations of the room.
So how do you build it?
One technique that has real legs is anchoring. Before the visit, you identify one or two non-negotiable behaviors, not a whole personality, just a couple of fixed points. For Daniel, it might be, I'll eat until I'm full and stop, regardless of what's left on the plate. Or, I'll buy the groceries that make sense to me and not relitigate that decision in the aisle. The key is that these are decided in advance and treated as settled. They don't require renegotiation in each new context.
That removes the in-the-moment negotiation with himself. He's not standing at the restaurant table doing internal math about whether leaving food is worth the imagined judgment. The decision was already made. He's just executing.
And that's the point. The cognitive load we talked about earlier, a lot of it comes from redeciding things in real time. Every time you're at a meal, you're running a fresh cost-benefit analysis. Anchoring collapses that. You make the decision once in a calm moment and then you just follow the rule.
It's almost like a pre-commitment. You're binding your future self to a decision, your past self made with a clear head.
And that's effective because your past self, sitting at home in Jerusalem, isn't flooded with the anxiety of the moment. He can think clearly about what he actually needs. Your future self, sitting at the restaurant in Connecticut, is flooded. He's not in a position to make good decisions, so you let the clear-headed version make the call.
What else?
Mental rehearsal. This sounds simple, but it's backed by decent research on visualization and performance. Between visits, you deliberately visualize yourself in the specific challenging scenarios, the restaurant, the grocery store, the dinner table, and you practice the internal script of acting according to your own needs without apology. You see yourself leaving food on the plate. You see yourself buying the tuna. You feel the discomfort and you stay with it.
Building neural pathways, so the behavior feels automatic rather than defiant.
Right. The first time you actually do it, it's going to feel like a statement. You're going to feel like everyone's looking at your plate. But if you've rehearsed it mentally, the gap between the feeling and the action is smaller. You've already done it 100 times in your head.
And the third piece, I think, is attribution retraining. Daniel mentioned that he's constructing a judgment that may not be there, so the skill is learning to generate alternative explanations for the social feedback you're perceiving.
This is classic cognitive reappraisal. When you feel judged, the default attribution is, they think I'm wasteful. The skill is to pause and generate alternatives. They're not even thinking about my plate. They're focused on their own meal. They're wondering if I'm still hungry and whether to offer me more. They're thinking about what to pick up from the hardware store tomorrow. The point isn't to pick the right one. The point is to break the certainty of the negative attribution.
Because the negative attribution feels true in the moment. It has this visceral certainty to it. You just know they're judging you. But you don't know. You're guessing. And the guess is being driven by anxiety, not evidence.
The APA has done work on this in family context specifically. Cognitive reappraisal. Actively generating alternative interpretations of ambiguous social cues is one of the most effective interventions for reducing interpersonal anxiety, and it's trainable. You get better at it with practice.
So anchoring reduces the decision load. Mental rehearsal builds the neural pathway. Attribution retraining breaks the certainty of the negative read. Those are three concrete skills. But there's a broader question here that I think Daniel is circling. How much of this is about the in-laws, and how much is about the asymmetry of being a guest?
I think it's mostly the asymmetry. The guest role inherently involves ceding control over your environment. You can't adjust the thermostat, the meal timing, the grocery list, the lighting, the noise level. And that loss of control amplifies small anxieties into larger ones because you can't do the normal things you do to regulate yourself. At home, if you're feeling bloated, you eat smaller portions for a few days and it's fine. In someone else's home, you're eating what's served when it's served, and you're trying not to be difficult about it.
The food waste thing is a specific trigger, but the underlying dynamic is about control and uncertainty. The food is just a stage where the psychological drama plays out.
I think that's why the advice to just stop caring what they think misses the point. Complete indifference isn't the goal, and it's not realistic. The goal is to accurately assess what they actually think and respond proportionally. That's a skill, not an attitude adjustment.
It's the difference between not caring and caring about the right things. You care about being a good guest. You care about participating in family meals. You care about your relationship with these people. Those are good things to care about. What you want to stop caring about is the phantom judgment that exists only in your head.
The way you do that's by getting better at reading the social environment accurately. Most of us are terrible at this. We think we're reading people, but we're really reading our own anxieties projected onto their faces. A neutral expression becomes disapproval. A moment of distraction becomes coldness. We're not observing, we're interpreting, and the interpretation is biased.
Part of the skill is becoming a better observer. actually looking at what's happening rather than what you fear is happening.
Yes, and that's hard in the moment because you're anxious and your attention is inward, but it's trainable. Between visits, you can practice in lower-stakes situations. When you're at a restaurant with friends, notice what you're assuming about their reactions and check it against what you can actually observe. Are they really looking at your plate, or are they looking at the menu, or their phone, or the server?
I want to come back to something Daniel said about the times he didn't participate in shared meals because he felt uptight. That's the cost. That's what makes this worth working on. He's missing time with people he flew across the world to see because he's tangled up in a psychological knot about leftovers.
The knot is real. I don't want to minimize it. The feelings are real even if the judgment isn't. But the cost of the knot is higher than the cost of the judgment would be even if the judgment were real. If his in-laws did think he was slightly wasteful, which they probably don't, that would be a minor thing, a quirk, the kind of thing families absorb and forget. Missing meals with them isn't minor.
That's a useful calibration. Ask yourself, what's the actual worst case here? They think I'm a little careless with groceries. Okay, is that worth skipping dinner over?
The math doesn't work. But anxiety doesn't do math. That's why you need the skills we're talking about. You can't reason your way out of it in the moment. You have to build the capacity in advance.
Daniel's question, what mental work can I do between now and the next visit? The answer is, you can build the anchoring rules now. You can do the mental rehearsal now. You can practice attribution retraining in your daily life now. These aren't things you deploy on the plane. They're things you build over months so they're ready when you land.
I'd add one more. Between visits, have the actual conversation with yourself about what you need, not what you think you should need or what a good guest would need, what you actually need. For Daniel, that might be, I need to eat smaller portions for medical reasons, and I need to not explain or justify that at every meal. Just name it, write it down, make it real. Part of self-concept clarity is knowing what your needs are in the first place.
A lot of people skip that step. They jump straight to, how do I manage the situation without first asking, what do I actually need from this situation?
Because asking what you need feels selfish, especially in a guest context where the whole role is built around accommodation. But you can't accommodate indefinitely without knowing your own requirements. Otherwise, you're just drifting, and the drift is what creates the anxiety.
The skill of being comfortable being yourself. It's not one thing, it's a cluster. Self-concept clarity, anchoring, mental rehearsal, attribution retraining, accurate observation, and underneath all of it, this willingness to say, I have needs, they're legitimate, and I can meet them without being a bad guest.
I spent 6 weeks with my wife's family in northern Sweden once, small town. The food norms were completely different. Meals were structured, seconds were expected. Leaving food on your plate wasn't just mildly awkward. It was seen as rejecting hospitality. Not a perception thing, a real norm.
The judgment Daniel's imagining, you were actually facing.
Different mechanism, same result. I was full, they were offering more, and saying no required a negotiation I didn't have the Swedish for. But here's the thing, Daniel might be right that the judgment is mostly in his head. I still think there's a real issue here about the asymmetry of knowledge. His in-laws have been running that household for decades. They know exactly how much leftover tuna they'll use. They know which brand they buy and why. Daniel doesn't. So he's operating with incomplete information, and that uncertainty is what creates the anxiety. The not knowing.
That's a really useful distinction. The uncertainty about household norms, not the norms themselves, is the primary driver.
The thing that saved me in Sweden was realizing my wife's family had a completely different relationship to food than I did. Just different. They came from a place where food was love and refusing food was refusing love. I came from a place where eating until you're full and stopping was normal and nobody read anything into it. Once I stopped trying to match the relationship to food and just had my own, the tension dissolved. Took me 4 weeks to get there.
4 weeks out of six.
I'm a slow learner.
But the point about structural uncertainty is important. It's not personal. It'd exist with any in-laws in any unfamiliar household. You don't know where the extra paper towels are kept. You don't know if leaving a light on is a thing. You don't know if they're saving that container for something specific. And each of those unknowns is a tiny decision point where you could get it wrong.
I counted once. In the first 3 days of a visit to someone else's house, you make something like 200 small decisions where you don't know the local norm. Which cupboard, which towel, how long to stay at the table, whether to offer to help with dishes or just do them or wait to be asked. Each one is trivial. 200 of them is exhausting.
Daniel's doing all of that, plus the food waste overlay, plus the medical portion thing, plus the compression of time, because the visit is precious.
The compression point is real. When I was in Sweden, I knew I'd be back in a few months. The stakes were lower. Daniel's doing this once a year, maybe less. Every moment feels like it counts more.
What do you do with that? If the uncertainty is structural and the stakes are high, what's the move?
You accept the uncertainty. You stop trying to get it right and just get through it. I don't mean that cynically. I mean you recognize that you're going to use the wrong towel and buy the wrong tuna and leave too much food on your plate at least once, and that's fine. That's the deal. You're a guest. Guests get things wrong. The hosts expect that, even if they don't say it.
They were guests once. They know.
They know. And if they're good people, which Daniel says they are, they're not keeping score. They're just glad you're there. The scorekeeping is happening entirely in your own head.
That idea of structural uncertainty, that the anxiety comes from not knowing the norms, not from the norms themselves, is a really useful way to think about this. It means the problem isn't the in-laws, and it isn't even Daniel's sensitivity. It's a feature of the situation. Anyone would feel it. The question is just how you handle it.
Handling it well doesn't mean eliminating the uncertainty. It means being okay with the uncertainty. Which is harder, but more realistic.
The second week was the worst for me. First week I was performing. Third week I started to relax. Fourth week I stopped caring about the food thing and just ate what I wanted. By week 5 I was part of the furniture. Week 6 I was sad to leave. The arc is real. You just have to ride it out.
The skill Daniel is asking about, being comfortable being yourself, it's learnable. But it's not about not caring. It's about caring about the right things. Specifically, about accurately reading the social environment rather than projecting worst-case scenarios onto it. And that's a practice, not a switch you flip.
The fact that Daniel is asking this question, that he wants to be a better guest and a more relaxed version of himself, that's itself the foundation of the skill he's looking for. He's already doing the self-awareness work that the anchoring and attribution techniques require. He just hasn't named it yet.
The open question, though, the thing we're sitting with, is what happens when the judgment isn't imagined? When your in-laws actually do have expectations that conflict with your needs? That's a different episode. Because the skills we talked about today only work when the gap is between perceived and actual judgment. When the judgment is real, you need a different toolbox.
Yeah, that's a harder conversation. But for Daniel's situation, based on everything he described, I think the gap is real. He's fighting a phantom. And the work between now and the next visit is about learning to see the phantom for what it is.
This has been my Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.